We brought our Those Were the Days microphones to Findlay Galleries on Michigan Avenue, where amidst the great paintings, we are going to talk with two charming ladies who are going to paint some word pictures for us about the old days of radio. We have Rita Ascott Boyd, who played Faye Perkins, that's Ma's daughter on Ma Perkins, on one side of the microphone. And on the other side of the microphone, we have a lady who was responsible for getting people up to the mic. And that's Alice Carey Rica, who was very much involved in casting the old programs in the old days of radio. Let's talk to Alice Carey Rica first. Alice, what exactly did you have to do to fill some of the roles on some of these programs?
Well, we had 20 programs a day at the height of our soap opera season. And, we had 9 directors that I was casting for. And we would hold auditions every Saturday till finally I had a bank of about 950 people, experienced radio actors and actresses, that we could draw from. And while you would be casting, for instance, Jack Armstrong, and you'd call the leads and you'd call, you know, for rehearsals or recording, and you get all the way down to the last person and he couldn't make it. And then you'd have to throw the whole show out, start all over again, pick a new time, start calling them back again. I ended up working until about 1 or 2 o'clock every morning.
Just to cast these
20 programs a day.
Mm-hmm. It's an awful lot of programs, though.
It was, and there were nine directors going all the time.
Did you ever find the job for Rita Ascott?
Oh, yes, that's how we met. We have a mutual birthday, so we've been celebrating ever since. Rita was one of the first stock company actresses. She was an ingenue, and she was a very busy girl, doing everything from baby cries. You want to do baby cry for us? I tormented her into doing it in a restaurant one time and startled everybody.
Well, this program is famous for baby cries, so let's have Rita Ascott Boyd renew her radio career today, and Those Were the Days, with a fantastic baby cry. Now, this is probably the first time that Ma Perkins' daughter ever cried.
Oh, no.
No, it wasn't. Huh?
It was sobbing. Sobbing, a real baby cry.
I'm not a baby.
Else.
I didn't cry as a baby.
No.
But I cried as a young girl in love and out of love and in between loves for many years. Practically, at one time, I will never forget, I walked into the studio one day and I had been crying for 2 years. So I said, doesn't this girl know how to do anything else but cry? And so the director said, well, I have news for you, because you're going to marry this boy, and you'll be happy for a while.
Until the storyline takes a left turn again.
Next 13 weeks.
Next 13 weeks, probably.
That's the only life anybody had was 13 weeks. These are depression days.
Was even a program like Ma Perkins on a 13-week cycle?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Now, how long did Ma run?
27 years.
27. Yeah. Went off the air in
57.
No, it was in New York at the time, right?
Or was it 52? I'm not sure.
It was in the late 50s,
yes,
I believe.
50s,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
George Fogel, the director of the show, was the real pop and a real innovator in the business, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Yes,
and he's one of the greatest. He's still, so many people from Chicago radio are in Hollywood now, and George holds them all together with a weekly luncheon meeting, and they all have a grand time. Wonder why everybody is in cold old Chicago.
Well, Phil Bowman, who directed the program after George,
yes,
told us about that too. And
yeah,
when he gets out to the West Coast, he likes to have
lunch. Yeah, old Pop Fogel, he was our boy. He hired me away from the agency. I worked for an agency on 20 mm-hmm. programs, and then George hired me to work alone for him.
On Ma Perkins.
Perkins.
Oh, I see.
But in between guys, we had, well, this is one of Rita's great jobs. We had a show called Court of Missing Heirs. It was on every Sunday and had a different movie star every week. And a man at an ad agency who had no idea what he was doing bought the theatrical properties. For instance, he bought Boston Blackie the Suave Englishman for George Raft. Was that something? And then we would have to go down every Sunday. we would go down and do this show. And then to save money, after you paid a movie star, you would save money on the rest of the cast by hiring people that could do more than one part. And then Rita would do a baby, and then she'd do a little girl, and she'd do an ingenue, and then she'd do a matron, and then she'd do an old lady. And we really got our money sort of out of Rita.
French girl.
Sounds like a cast of hundreds and a cast of one.
French girl, a Chinese girl, an Irish girl, an Indian maiden.
Let's get that baby now before we forget now.
If I can hear him.
What was wrong with that baby? What would you say? Was it a
cranky?
Just a cranky little kid.
I had a very interesting experience out at the University of Chicago when Dr. Robert Hutchins was there. And they were celebrating the anniversary of a nurse who had been in obstetrics for, practically from the time she began her career. So they said they wanted her to be interviewed and then have a newborn baby cry. So they called me from NBC, and I said, I don't know how a newborn baby sounds. And they said they just screamed their head off. They took me up in the room, and one was being born, you know, and the doctor slapped it, and they had that little microphone.
Yeah.
So it does. They have a very loud cry. I did it. That always amused me.
Now, when you were on Ma Perkins as Faye, what kind of reaction did you get from the listening audience? The people, I understand, used to send mail in, and they would be in sympathy with you, or they would say you weren't doing this right, or you should do that. But they often give advice.
Well, they would tell me that Ma was conferring with, especially during the Dr. White sequence. They said, "Now Ma knows that Dr. White is married, and you don't know he's married, and you better listen to your mother." Because she doesn't want to tell you, because she doesn't want to break your heart. And then when Paulette was born, I got 50 yards of tatting. I got so many presents for Layette, they actually believed that baby was born.
Mm-hmm.
And little did they know that you were not only the mother, but the baby.
And one reaction I had just before I was having my love affair with Paul Henderson, and he was, you know, going to Washington, becoming a very sophisticated congressman. One of the girls wrote in at the time and said, "Well, after all, you shouldn't really go to Washington because you're too nice a girl to get mixed up with that sophisticated society." But from Tennessee came a letter from a young man who said, "I do not want you to go to Washington. I'm very much in love with you. My mother approves of you. We have a beautiful home down here, and I'm coming up to Chicago. And just as soon as we meet them, maybe we can set the wedding date." And I was already married. So I didn't know what to do. I took the letter into the program director at NBC, and every time I walked out of the studio, I expected to see this boy, and I was going to have to tell him, "I'm sorry, I can't marry you. I'm already married."
Breaking in real life. Breaking a million hearts.
Early in the game, found out that the audiences had tremendous memories, and if we had, for instance, we had one writer that was working on four scripts at the same time, like Judy and Jane and maybe Orphan Annie. I'm just saying that. I don't remember exactly. But to make things easier on himself, he'd have everybody get kidnapped at the same time, one in each plot. And then he'd have everybody doing something else. You know, it was easier on him. He was pouring them out. These were the real early days of it, and he was having a grand time. But as a result, he made errors. And that was what started the first job of editing, was to watch these things. For instance, like Mr. Gumpox, the horse's name, you know, in Vickenstade, people would remember that for months if you didn't mention it. And one time we had, sometimes a whole one day in a show would take almost a 13-week cycle. You remember
yes,
that?
Yes.
On Jack Armstrong, we had the kids get in a rowboat, row out to this yacht, and then the action on the yacht went week after week after week. They came back off the boat and got in the rowboat, and were rowing, and you could hear the oars. All the kids wrote in that the original rowboat had muffled the oars.
you know,
can't put anything off.
Well, even sometimes, you know, we'd fool the clients because I'm Ma Perkins and very hot in my sequins to say. And I won an audition for a gangster's Ma on Guiding Light, which followed Ma Perkins. I don't know how I won that audition because I didn't know a thing about a gangster's Ma. But anyway, Erna Phillips wanted a girl with a sweet voice, but you know. Mm-hmm. So I did this for about 6 months, and I didn't want Parchin Young to know about it. And one day, Bill Ramsey, who was then head of radio, you know, walked into the control room, and he said, "What are you doing there?" And I said, "Well, I have a show." And she said, "What part do you play?" And I said, "Judy Shea." He said, "Not the gangster's Ma." I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, we've been listening to you right around long, but we didn't know that you were Faye." And I said, "I'm so glad you didn't, but I couldn't continue."
Oh, he did take you off.
They couldn't conceive of Faye being a gangster.
No, no. I fooled them for a long time.
Another secret of old-time radio divulged right here on Those Were the Days.
That's right.
Well, there was no union in those days, and the kids were exploited shamelessly by the agencies because you could they would make me call up maybe 50 people to audition, not only to audition for parts within a show, but a show itself. If they wanted to, well, for instance, Arnold Grimm's daughter, we worked on that, and of course we're getting paid by the agency. The actors are coming and going and working and cutting records and everything. Not a nickel for one of them. And their only hope was those who were selected, if the show sold, that they would get the part. But there was no guarantee of that. And many of them didn't. I think only the
just
two leads.
Yes. Yes.
Well,
right.
Now, let's
Seymour,
say...
You know, was known.
And Seymour.
TV, she was one of them. Yeah.
For example, if you needed a person to be a character on a program for, let's say, 5 days, just 1 week, and you found the right party, what kind of money did they get for doing those five shows at that time?
Before the union?
Before the union.
Oh, $15. We got $15 for a network broadcast, for two network broadcasts. I think we got $5 for one network broadcast, but $15 if we had a repeat on NBC. If we had the first show on CBS, then the second show on NBC, well, then we would have a repeat. $15
a
program.
The same show?
Same show.
One on CBS, one on NBC?
Yes. The same way with Ma Perkins. We had our first show on CBS, which went to the East Coast, the West Coast, and then the second show went to the East Coast.
And it was on recording, too.
And it was on recording.
Saturation. Yeah.
So we recorded about 4 weeks in advance.
And that would go to the local stations, which were not affiliated, right?
And to Australia, went overseas there.
Did you ever hear about the station in Florida that played all the records 7 days a week with Ben Goose instead of 5 days?
No.
And they ran out of Ma Perkins records on a Tuesday 1 week. They weren't even listening because in the middle of the week it was
they
saying,
played
to you on Monday, you know.
Yeah. Yes, when I was in New York, I commuted between New York and Chicago for 3 years because the show had moved to New York, and I persuaded the author to write me out on Monday and Friday so I'd have a long weekend. Well, one time he couldn't do it. I was in on Monday and not in again until Friday, so we had a suspense holdover until Monday.
Oh, yeah, the Friday, the Friday holdover.
That was the days when you took more than an hour and a half to get to an hour to get new. It took about 3.5 to 4 hours to fly to New York.
Yeah.
Now, an hour and a half.
When, as the show went into the 50s there, was most of it done on transcription then?
Was it was
still live. Still live all the way till the end?
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. About the last 10 weeks, I believe, the show was
recorded. Oh, I see.
And I think we only had one network then. I think it was only on CBS.
CBS was the last holdout of the old soap operas. I think they had about four or six that continued right up to the
end. I was in Chicago when six shows left on one day. We had a complete exit. I believe we were in California at that time. Six shows left. So we were the only show left. Everybody was on the phone.
I was in the East. I was working with Margaret Sanger
on
a couple of soap operas there, and they were really something.
Six shows in one day.
The New York actors always set me, set my teeth on edge because they just didn't seem the type for the Middle Western.
Well, the funny part of
soap opera
was, Alice, when we went to New York, right? If they held an audition, they'd say, "Well, did you have have you ever been to the Midwest? We'd like to have an actor who was born in the Midwest. And I said, why did we come to New York? I could never figure that out, you know.
My favorite one was one we had with a new villainous type girl came in, and she had a real tigerish name, Cheetah. And the New York actor would always say, good morning, Cheater.
Cheater. They always call me Reader in New York.
I know.
First time I was ever called Reader.
Well, they didn't have the same feeling in New York. I had to work backstage a lot with them there. And they were a little ashamed of being in this fuzzy business. And they were, you know, terribly afraid you wouldn't think they were going to be real swell New Yorkers.
Mm-hmm.
Or here in Chicago, everybody did a really good job. The best illustration was when the top actors and actresses of Hollywood were in here. Every Sunday we had a different one. They demanded all the rehearsal, not the kids. The kids were good, just like that. They were, you know, automatically good. Every one of them, they were really terrific. But you would take, a top flight actor. Orson Welles, he had Raymond Massey, Errol Flynn, Francis Lutter.
Well, most of us were quick character studies. You know, they were always quick. They say, well, how can you get into all these characters? Well, we were accustomed to it. We were accustomed to be given this. Mm-hmm. As Alice told you, when we would audition for a show, we needed it. It was our bread and butter.
Oh,
so we'd go home and we'd,
you
know, we'd practice.
But I never saw a poor sport.
No.
Never saw a poor sport. And this was really serious, too. I mean, your heart was in your eyes when you were auditioning. It would just killed me. And I could hardly watch half the time. I would always know who had any money, who had a sick mother at home, you know.
Who was starving to death.
Little kids. There was one little girl, remember, Alice Goody, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She was the mainstay of her family, and she'd come out, her eyes were just sparkling with tears that she wouldn't let drop. You know, I had her scared to death that I'd throw her out of the business if she ever cried, because the producers were afraid of girls that cried if they lost. They didn't want them even to audition them. So she finally...
She married a very wealthy man.
Yeah, she married a millionaire. So
she saved her tears for the right moment.
No, she was a great... She was a good little actress.
Yes, she was. She was a very good actress.
Yeah.
Alice, you told me the other day when we spoke on the telephone about an incident involving John Hodiak when he was a radio actor in Chicago. Would you like to tell us again?
Well, Johnny came from Hamtramck in Detroit, and he had worked a station there, and he'd saved up enough money to take a certain number of weeks fling at Chicago, which was the center of the whole business. And he was he made friends with some of the boys that I knew, and I was single at the time, and was going with. So Johnny was in the big social crowd we were in, and I was conscious of him being in town. We later became very close friends. But I knew from the boys that he had only enough money to last him, let's say, till next Monday. Meanwhile, I had a bigger list of actors than NBC did. And when they were casting Little Abner, they ran out of everybody they had, and they had still hadn't decided who to hire. So they called me and asked me if I could recommend anybody, and I checked out all the character people I knew that they would know, and they had tried them all. So I said, there are two new boys in town, and I could send them over to you. One's Johnny Hodiak and one's Durward Kirby. Durward had just come in from Indiana. He was taking a plane too. Johnny got Little Abner the day before he had to go, and then Durward got the job as the announcer.
Mm-hmm.
So they were both set right away with contracts. Then Johnny got Lone Wolf.
Yes.
Remember?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he was a marvelous actor.
Well, how long was he in Chicago before he went to Hollywood then?
Well, let's see. I'd say about 3 years.
Just before the war.
Yeah, while I was living in New Jersey, he came and stayed with my room at my roommate's home. She and her husband had a big home in Jersey, and he stayed with us while he had his first movie test. And he got the word while he was staying with us, and we had a celebration, which I'm sure the trees are still ringing in the forest there. Anyway, then he went on to make Lifeboat from that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But when I was out in Hollywood, when I was out in Hollywood, he always came to our, you know, our weekly coffee lunches, and he was still a big buddy of everybody in Chicago. He was really a great guy.
Rita, what other programs? You mentioned Guiding Light. What other things did you do in Chicago? Was it mostly in the soap opera?
No, I worked on the Chicago Theater of the Year. I did leads on that, The Voice of Marion Clare. That's when the part required a light voice.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also worked on First Nighter, and I worked on Grand Hotel for a while. I was a signature on Grand Hotel, signature voice for Grand Hotel. And remember that. And then I worked on Road of Life.
Were you ever in Molly in the Movies?
No, I never was Molly in the Movies. No, as a stepmother. I was a stepmother. A lot of the shows I couldn't work because they were conflicting with Ron Perkins because of our two network broadcasts.
Because
then
of the timing of those, right.
But then I had other shows, personality shows. I was Aunt Rita of the Sometimes Funnies for many years.
You were Aunt Rita?
Yeah, that's the Rita that she always gets. Yeah.
Well, that would have been the...
That was the
Times then. It wasn't Sometimes.
It was just the Times. Aunt Rita and Uncle Charlie. Charlie, who played Shuffle on Ma Perkins, was my Uncle Charlie.
Charles Eggleston.
That's
right.
Yeah,
right.
And then I also had the Aunt Rita's Children's Hour, which was a riddle box program. And I would read the riddles that the children would send in, and then I'd send them a pencil box with my name on it. And one time, I got a letter from the president of the Continental Bank. And he said, "Now, dear Aunt Rita, I could buy my little boy a pencil box for maybe two or three, but he will have no part of it. He wants to win one from you." So he said, "Here is a riddle I'm sure you've never read." Because he said he sent in every Sunday, he sent riddles to you. And he said, "Always is that you have read the riddle." Anyway, this riddle I read, and I sent him a pencil box, and I wish you could have seen the letter. He said he had the happiest little boy in the whole city of Chicago, which made me feel good.
Yeah,
you know.
That's wonderful.
Then I read birthdays, and one time when I was on the air, my woman called up, and the announcer answered the phone, and she said, "Would you please tell Aunt Rita to read my little boy's birthday on the air? I promised him I would send it in, and I forgot it, and he's sitting there waiting for her to read his name." So the boy slipped the name under me. I didn't know this until I was off the air. And I read his name, and so then I had a flood of mail. One time I had, 1 year, I had 50,000 children write to me.
That's enormous.
And you answered every letter?
Well, I had, but I read all the letters. Mm-hmm. But I still had, Broadcasting Magazine carried the story. 50,000 children wrote Dear Aunt Rita.
Isn't that terrific? And I wonder how many letters P&G got when they gave away live monkeys on Houseboat Hannah.
Oh, Houseboat Hannah. I'd forgotten about that.
Houseboat Hannah wasn't heard in Chicago, was it?
No.
It was originated here.
Yeah. I think that was the show. They gave away live monkeys.
Yeah. Norman,
they heard from
Gottschalk was on that
Norman
show,
Gottschalk.
I think,
yeah.
Right.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah, Norm.
And
yes,
Henrietta Tedrow, wasn't she on that show?
Oh, yeah. Henrietta.
She was the lead, wasn't
she? Charlie was the...
Yes, that's
did
right.
The, yeah. Other,
we're going to pick this conversation up in just a moment, but radio still has sponsors, and we've got to hear a word from one of ours. This is Chuck Shaden. We're back at Findlay Galleries talking to Rita Ascott Boyd, who played Faye Perkins on the Ma Perkins series, and Alice Carey Rica, who was a casting director for the good old golden age of radio. Alice, what can you remember about... getting jobs for these people? We've heard so many things about everybody scrounging for a part to get that $15 or the $5 or to get a job. What was your role in all of this in helping some of these newcomers?
Well, I kept track of all the dialects they could do, the age range of their voices, whether like Rita they could do half a dozen dialects and then go from babies on up to old ladies. Or a lot of the men would change their names, and you know, they come in and decide to be somebody on a different name, and I'd have to memorize it. Eventually, I ended up memorizing the telephone numbers of 900 actors or more, and all the directors, and most of the directors of other agencies in NBC. We were the only agency with a casting director, so I was literally sitting on all the talent, you know, knew where everybody was. As a result, we changed my home phone number to an unlisted number about 10 times in 1 year which did no good. As soon as I gave it to one, all the actors gave it to everybody else, you know. And my mother almost went mad, you know, with the phone calls. And at night then, so she said to me that she was not going to be responsible for half the radio industry while I was out dancing. So I took a bag full of nickels, for nickel telephones at the time, and I go off on a date. And if a producer lost an actor, or an actor became sick, or they discovered a conflict, or any kind of an emergency, the producer would call my home. My mother would have me paged wherever I went. I had to leave word where I was all the time. Then I would talk to the director from a public phone, find out what his problem was. Sometimes, like with an announcer suddenly gets a sore throat. Now he needs a hard sell announcer. No, I have to memorize all this. He needs a hard sell announcer. A man that has a clean tuxedo because it's going to be an audience program. So I knew every boy that had a tuxedo. I knew all their styles. I knew whether the tuxedo was in the cleaners or not. I knew if he was sitting in a rowboat. I found a fellow that way once. I had a kid row out and bring him in. Because I could find them. I had private planes looking for them. Yeah. So I'd cast the show from the dance floor, practically, wherever I was. And they'd all call me, men that I didn't work for. It was kind of a very pleasant business. Everybody got along so well together.
You really must have been a much sought-after personality yourself.
Oh, I was
yourself.
Terribly popular, I can assure you.
And loved. She was terribly popular and loved.
Did you ever get any dates from fellas who had something else in mind, a part on a radio program?
Oh, yes.
Or something like
that? Oh, yes. That was the nice part about being a young girl in charge of all this. I had my choice, didn't I? Read them all, the handsome boys. I went to one dance, the engineer's ball. I went with six escorts.
I remember that.
One of them was Johnny Hodiak, too. Yeah. Just one of them. However, it came out all right for them because they chipped in to buy my corsage, so it couldn't cost them much.
You remember that's the John Hodiak pedal and then the lead from.
Right, yeah.
Who were the others on that date? Can you remember?
Herb Nelson and Barry Drew and Dolph Nelson, probably. Mm-hmm. Oh, and Stefan Lazar. He was the madman of the Polish stations. He was a very handsome and dynamic young man who cut a wide swath for himself in the service later and received a lifetime scholarship to Columbia and commissioned by the King of Sweden to study language roots. Just a brilliant young man, an absolute madman to know. He was one of them. Oh, yes. He was a very exciting person. He used to translate Ma Perkins' commercials.
Mm-hmm.
They were broadcast in English on the Polish stations, and then he would give the Occidental commercial in Polish.
The actual program was broadcast in English, mm-hmm. but the commercials were in Polish.
Yeah, they
didn't
want to take any chance on missing any points in the selling.
you may have missed the story, but you certainly wouldn't
miss the commercial.
Well, how would that come out then? How would that, oh, that Occidental sparkle, how would that come out in Polish?
The only word you would understand of Stefan's was Occidental. He used to do it as a party thing at parties, and Johnny Hodiak would tell the story of Little Red Riding Hood in Ukrainian.
Uh-huh.
And it was so funny that people begged for him to stop because he played all the parts. He played the little girl and tying the bonnet on the little girl by the mommy, you know, and skipping through the woods, and he'd dodge around the furniture being the wolf. And oh, it's very all in Ukrainian. Mm-hmm. And you knew what part it was from this acting, you know. The kids had a... They all practiced that. Were you ever in one of those where they would throw out a plot and then they'd all make it up as they...
Oh, yes, I did.
Yeah, that was just for the fun.
For the clinics here for a while, we did that, yes.
Rita, how did you get your job as Faye on Ma Perkins?
Alice called me for the audition, and they auditioned for 3 weeks for the show. And the third week, while we were all... We dwindled down, I think it must have been around 500-600 girls auditioned for that show. And so, finally, when they kept telling me to come back, so I came back to find, he said that we were going to make a platter of it at that time. Mm-hmm. They didn't tape it. and send it down to Procter & Gamble, and we would know the following week. My number was 9. So when I got the call for the rehearsal at NBC, I didn't go out. I think it was on a Wednesday. I didn't go out for the whole weekend. Everybody was wanted to congratulate me. I didn't show up anywhere. I just stayed home and made my first appearance at NBC on a appointed date.
Well, did you... What was the particular quality of your voice as opposed to the other people? Did you ever find out why?
Well, the Angelou voice was a perfect balance with Miss Payne, Virginia Payne, who played my first.
Uh-huh.
And
this is something they were looking for.
Yes,
then they had contrasts and balances.
Mm-hmm.
And
but also mm-hmm. they expected you. Then they had formed a stock company, and they wanted you to be able to do a baby cry. They wanted you to be able to double. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I fulfill those roles from my previous experience on, what was the name of that show on WBBM that I used to do the spy on Sundays that Phil Bowman directed? I can't think of it. Something about, History in the Making was the name of the show. It was on Sunday afternoons on WBBM.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I really gained most of my... Phil directed it for a while, and also Lou Jacobson directed it.
Mm-hmm.
I think Lou was one that cast me in it. And that's how I get most of my experience on character roles.
In that show.
Uh-huh. History in the Making.
Well, you were...
That qualified me for it.
Right. You were with Ma Perkins then from the very beginning?
No, it started in Cincinnati in 35, I believe, mm-hmm. and I didn't join it until 37.
Someone
and
else
came to
played
Chicago, yes.
Faye at that time?
And when the show moved to Chicago, right, then I think this girl... Well, in fact, she went apart on Bachelor's Children.
The other girl,
and so then I auditioned in Virginia Temple's.
Was it in Cleveland or Cincinnati?
Cincinnati.
Well, they tested...
Margie Hanna.
Where did they test Jack Armstrong?
I don't remember.
Because it was called...
Detroit,
it was called Don Dunlap.
In Detroit,
it was the Century Progress that just opened, and Big Don jumped in the swimming pool and won all those swimming events and everything. For a beginning, that was a big watery opening show. All nothing but splash.
Yeah.
And the sound man did all the work.
Yes, he
but
did.
For some reason, everybody went yick about the name Don Dunlap, and we took a vote and changed it to Jack Armstrong.
It's a stronger name.
Yeah.
To use her arm to think about that. Well, I can't visualize or I can't think that anyone would ever shout, you know, Don Dunlap. Don Dunlap.
Yeah.
You really can't even say it.
No. Yeah, that was it was only about a week or so, I think.
It wasn't on the air, I don't think, was it?
I think it was. Yeah, I think it was. I was the editor at the time.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was just a script editor at the time. And, then when I got promoted to casting director, which was marvelous, but nobody knew anything about casting, so I was as good as anybody else.
Did you ever do any program, any acting on the radio yourself?
Oh, heavens, no. As I told you, I couldn't even count up to 10 in front of a live mic. I would go all to pieces. So the engineers thought it was very funny. You know, they said, you're on the air. Fall over dead.
And what are you doing today?
Public relations.
You have your partner in Impact Public
mm-hmm,
Relations,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm. We mostly do interiors and furnishings and jewelry, art, things like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And
got my taste for all these during the Depression.
Yeah.
And that's why we're at Findlay Gallery today,
yes,
too.
Right.
Right, right. Rita Ascott Boyd, you are a present editor of
Key This Week in Chicago, the entertainment magazine.
Right, and everyone inside and outside of town finds that a most interesting publication.
Yes, I think so. I think
sure.
They do. It's been very popular.
Well, now she's still connected with show business this way. She covers all the opening shows.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
Right.
And I still have the show on the Saturdays. We tape Unshackled, which is sponsored by the Pacific Garden Mission.
Right.
And
this is the last radio drama in the country,
isn't it?
Unshackled.
And it's broadcast on 5 continents, so it has a big following.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
And this is taped when?
On Saturdays. It's a half-hour show.
Every Saturday evening?
Every Saturday afternoon.
Uh-huh.
And we have a live audience. We did it for a long time at Boulevard Recording on Dearborn Street, and now we're doing it at the Pacific Garden Mission. The Boulevard Recording has moved to LaSalle.
Can How do you get tickets? To
Right to the Pacific Garden Mission.
Pacific Garden Mission.
Mm-hmm.
And that's on State Street.
South State.
South
yes.
State in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And they will send the tickets?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now,
or else they'll just tell you to report to the mission and they will take mm-hmm. you.
At what time is that on?
4:30 Saturday afternoons.
That's good, because this show goes off the air at 4.
So
you can listen to this and get right over to the Pacific Garden Mission and watch radio drama. Well, this is great.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of people who would like to see a radio program put together today, something that's not tapes and records
yes.
and
it's interesting.
Chatter.
You know, I don't think people realize how much give and take there was in front of the microphone. You know, George Fogel was particularly fussy about this, and he would identify a good actor as against a careless actor, as a person that didn't project any feeling mm-hmm. across to the other person. For instance, if you were had come to the end of your lines and Rita still had to give a curtain speech, he would be furious at you if you walked away from the microphone. You really had nothing else to do and nobody could see her. You would think, why should I bother to stay?
Mm-hmm.
But you would help Rita by standing there and look her right in the eyes while she talked to you. That was considered
that. That was very important.
Very important.
Whether or not there was an audience
could be seen at all. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you know, in New York, speaking of the lackadaisical manner in which
yeah.
they do things in New York, and on life can be beautiful. Chi-Chi.
Yeah.
One of the actors came in, he was all dark, he was only, well, in fact, they never rehearsed the scripts as conscientiously as we did.
Mm-hmm.
They'd read through them, that would be it. Anyway, he had forgotten that he had the last line in the show. He walked out of the studio.
Oh, the
and the star
line.
After him didn't pull him back in because he had the last line. Something like, goodbye, I'll see you tomorrow, something
yeah.
like that. I never will forget it because I was standing outside the door and she was dragging him in. She said, you got the last line.
Oh, my stars. Oh,
well, we're just about up to the last line in this interview.
Right.
But I have one question to ask of both of you. Rita, you were on the Mal Perkins program for many years, and Alice, you did a lot of the casting of the characters on the Mal Perkins program. I ask this because everybody ever connected with Mal Perkins. What was Ma's first name?
She never had a first name. She never had a first name.
She was just plain
Ma.
That was all.
Oh, yes, it would have been very upsetting, even if
no.
there were one written somewhere. I'm sure it would have bothered everybody. Anonymity was sought after. There were no stars, you know, nobody knew who played Ma.
No, well, we know now that Virginia
yeah.
Payne
yeah.
was
yeah.
Ma Perkins, but
well,
Ma, it was not Mary Perkins.
Oh, no,
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 just
no,
it was just
Ma.
Ma Perkins. And it was Pa Perkins. We never had
yeah,
identified.
Yeah.
And Shuffle Shelby, you never knew.
Never knew what his name
because
was.
Of the reason they called him Shuffle, because he always shuffled along. Or,
right.
Just
but Faye, we knew was Faye.
That's right.
Yes, that's right.
Thank you very, very much for being with us this afternoon. We appreciate you being here.
It's a lot of fun for us.
Let us all have a slice out of the past, mm-hmm. the near past, mm-hmm. from these charming ladies. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
We're saluting the funny papers today, and we have a very interesting guest with us this afternoon. Those of you who are youngsters between 1936 and 1952 may remember Aunt Rita Reads the Funnies on WLS every Sunday morning along about 11:30. Now, hold up your hands. Let's see how many of you remember Aunt Rita Reads the Funnies. I'm looking out through the flickering green eye now. Oh, yes, there's Johnny and Betty, oh, Susie and Patty, and I see David, Christine, oh, they all remember Aunt Rita Reads the Funnies. Well, we're going through the magic of radio, we're going back to 1936 and listening to Aunt Rita Reads the Sun-Times Funnies with a copy of this month's Sun-Times.
Well, girls and boys, let's take a look at the funnies this morning and tomorrow. Tomorrow, today. Today we turn over, we find Nancy. And Nancy is coming out of a dance studio, and she says, tomorrow they're going to teach us the swan dance. And in the next panel, she says, I wonder what that swan dance looks like. And in the very last panel, she sees some ducks or swans. They look swans in the water there, and they're in a big bubble as the cartoonist draws them. And she plays her little harmonica, and she says, "Come on, show me how that dance goes." And that's right, they are swans, beautiful swans. So there they are up in the bubble, and they're dancing around so much they've got their necks entwined around each other. Ernie Bushmiller has written that little comic strip for us this morning. And girls and boys, look down right underneath Nancy's comic strip, we find Rivets. And Rivets is standing beside a lemonade stand, and there's a big pitcher of lemonade on the carton, and two little glasses. And Rivets comes up and he sees the little boy who's selling the lemonade walk away. And he says, "Hope he puts some sugar in." And there in the next picture, look what he's doing. He's got his little nose right down in that pitcher, and he's drinking every single bit of that lemonade. But in the next panel, he can't get the pitcher off. So what does he do? He comes back to the house, to his master, with that pitcher over his head, and he says, "Too much sugar." That's Rivets. Rivets and Nancy. Let's turn over one page and if we can find the Berries. Oh, and here's the Berries and here's Mary Worth. And here comes Mr. Berry. He comes in into the front door and he says, "Hi, sweetie, I'm home." And then he looks around and he says, "Well, I guess I'm the only one." Well, at least there's a note. And then he picks it up and it says, "Dear Peter, if you're hungry, light the burner under the beans." And then on the last panel, he said, "Then when you smell something burning, eat the beans or dump them in the garbage disposer. I shall be home by then. Love, Pat." Well, that's not a very good homecoming for Peter Berry, I would say. And down here is lovely Mary Worth. And we see in the first panel, it looks to me like a castle. I don't know, it's a big mansion of some sort. You look really close, girls and boys. See if you can figure it out. I'll wait a few minutes until I see what she's doing. You figured out a mansion? All right. Now, there's voices coming out of that. And we hear, "You were pretty brutal with Mr. Fraser for a woman who pretends to be tolerant, Mrs. Worth." And Aunt Mary says, "There can be tolerance for those who seek to profit from human weakness, Christy." And in the next picture, which is the next panel, Mary Worth speaks up and she says, "Tell me, can you with good conscience appear in his play as the part requires you to be seen?" And Chrissy says, "I am an actress, and this is the best chance I ever had." And then, I don't know this woman, but she comes in and she says, "Mary, darling, I couldn't help but overhearing. Forgive me, but your penchant for meddling is going a little too far, my dear." And Mary Worth speaks up. She says, "Run along, Chrissy. I think my cousin and I need to have an understanding." And that's the end of the funnies for today, girls and boys. We'll have to wait until next Sunday till we find out what this young actress is going to do on the Mary Worth comic strip.
Well, Aunt Rita, we think that was groovy, to use a word from today. Aunt Rita.
I saw those before.
These are just three panel strips here, too, from a daily Sun-Times.
Yes,
instead
of sheet,
the color comics from the Sunday Sun-Times. Rita, Aunt Rita is, of course, maybe not, I shouldn't say of course, maybe you don't know, but she is Rita Ascott Boyd, a very familiar voice to Chicagoans who used to listen to Aunt Rita Reads the Funnies every Sunday morning on WLS from 1936 until 52.
Right.
How did the funnies differ today from those that we used to read, or don't they differ?
I think they're a little more scientific. There's more science fiction in the funnies now. Although I do believe some of the philosophy and humor still remain. I haven't looked at them too closely lately. I'm afraid to get nostalgic about the whole thing. I'm afraid I want to start all over again.
Did you get many comments from your young listeners?
Oh, yes. One little boy was quite upset because I would read the funnies earlier because he had to go to church at that time. I had problems there.
Well, others would rush home from church, I suppose, to get to,
yes,
to listen to
them. But the mothers and fathers loved it. They didn't have to read the funnies to the children.
They were off the hook.
So I'd get nice Christmas presents. Say, "Thank you for reading the funnies to my children."
Everybody's Aunt Rita. Thank you, Rita Ascott Boyd, for reading the funnies today on Those Were the Days.